Welcome to the 81st episode of the Loose Threads podcast, a show about the rapidly changing consumer economy. This episode is brought to you by Loose Threads membership, which gives you actionable analysis and insights that drive growth, and Loose Threads Espresso, your energizing and high-pressure filter for consumer news and context. We also have a newsletter that features the latest open letters to CEOs, podcasts with industry leaders, and news from Loose Threads. Check it all out at loosethreads.com. Joining me today is Melissa Mash, a co-founder of Dagnan Dover. She started the brand after working at Coach and seeing how women were sacrificing function for fashion, which led her to wonder if these two attributes were actually mutually exclusive.
It's about the thoughtfulness of the pockets. It's about the marketing imagery that goes with it. It's about the messaging that we stand for. It's about how it makes you feel.
She quickly realized a better solution was possible, and ever since, the brand has created a range of bags and accessories that give its customers the tools they need to get through the day with everything in tow. Here's my talk with Melissa Mash. So why don't we start, I guess, just talk a bit about your background, then we can work our way up to this company existing.
I went to NYU for undergrad, and while I was there, I had a bunch of internships in fashion. But in one of my last internship roles, I was with Coach. And there I was interning in the wholesale sales division. And so I had a great experience there, started my career after undergrad there, and I was managing the brick and mortar wholesale accounts. So that was our businesses at Bloomingdale's, Macy's, and so on. And then this was 2008 and e-commerce was starting. And so I wanted to be part of the team that helped launch the wholesale e-commerce channel. So I was given that promotion. And so we were launching the Coach brand on Macy's.com, Nordstrom.com, and Dillard's.com. And then after that, I was pretty bored. And I thought, okay, that's really interesting. This customer is really different than who's been shopping in stores and department stores. But I really want international experience. I really want to manage a full team. I don't want to just manage like one or two people. I really want to continue to develop myself. And so I told Coach that I was leaving. I was moving to London at the time with my boyfriend, now husband. He had a new job. He was getting set up there. And I was hitting the ground running, looking for a job. And Coach called me up and they were like, hey, actually, you'd be perfect to turn around our first European store, which has a lot of issues. We want you to fix everything. So that means manage a 9-person team, which is all international speakers because it was based at Heathrow Terminal 5. Travel retail, which is also a different type of experience. And they're like, we need you to improve the operations. The operations are a disaster. The buy is a disaster. The visual merchandising looks terrible. Getting past security, all these like things that you have to know in travel retail. We just need you to do it and to fix it. And so there I was, 25 years old, and I was given this monumental task of representing the Coach brand to Europe. And it was very successful. So I was able to work with this team and work in a store every day. This was the first time that I wasn't working with buyers directly, but I was working with customers directly. And people would come in every day and they would say, oh my gosh, my water bottle just exploded all over my $1,000 laptop. Do you have anything so that I can store and protect my laptop so this doesn't ever happen again? Or they'd say, oh, my keys are constantly scratching my laptop and my bag because they're all just rolling around in there. Do you have anything to keep it organized? Or I can't find my wallet. I'm trying to pay for this bag. I can't find my wallet. I can't find my boarding pass. And so it was just sort of an unending list of problems that people had with their bags. And since the store was at Heathrow Terminal 5, it was a British Airways exclusive terminal, super posh. There was Prada, Dior, Gucci, and then there was, of course, Longchamp available everywhere, Tumi available everywhere. And people weren't happy with the options. They wanted something ideally that was, you know, under $300, that was fashionable, but also had awesome pockets. Not just a lot of pockets, but the right types of pockets. And they also wanted something that, you know, didn't have crazy logos all over it. This was 2009. This was the beginning of logo fatigue in the world. So that's where I started to see, okay, this is the age of Bobble Bar. This is the age of Bonobos. Direct-to-consumer is a thing. This is part of the future. It's only a matter of time before someone does it really well for bags and hits a sweet spot. And I want to be that person. So that's where I first came up with the idea. I suddenly realized like, okay, I need to go back to business school. I didn't ever think I'd go back to grad school. I'm really all about like doing things through experience versus like sitting in a classroom. That's why I had so many internships in college. So I was sort of like, oh, gross. I'm going to be like back taking tests again. But I needed to, you know, I really needed formal business training. I needed the network to help launch this.
Before you keep going, what would happen when you would report these things back to Coach?
So, I mean, I would tell them, but, you know, it's a big machine. And not only that, but that's not their thing. That is not part of their brand identity. Part of their brand identity is heritage. It's buttersoft leather. It's not rooted in functionality. So to say that, you know, you need to do all these things for this one market, for this one store, is just sort of not super practical. But I do remember prior, when I was working in corporate, all the time during market, buyers would tell us, like, you know, so many of our customers use your guys' baby bags because they have so many pockets. They love it. Whether they're a businesswoman, whether, you know, everyday person, fashionable person, they're like, people love the pockets. So that was always something that at Coach we knew, but it just wasn't the focus.
And you had seen that even though you were in one market at Heathrow, that you started to feel this had a more global possibility.
Absolutely, because this was my own problem too. So throughout my life, I'd had many handbag problems. I'll spare you like the long list of them. One of them was my phone while I was studying abroad getting soaked in my bag because a water bottle had exploded all over my bag because, you know, it was just like laying sideways. And the phone, you know, cost me 300 euros to replace, which was super painful for a college student. And then also when I had left Coach Corporate, they had gifted me this like $1,000 bag that had been made for like the ultimate executive. The point was that like even though it was supposed to be like the ultimate business bag, it didn't actually fit a laptop. The laptop poked out at the top. So you looked ridiculous carrying it. And it was 6 pounds too. So it was all sorts of impractical. So through my own experiences, through everyone, you know, in my peer group, and especially when I went back to business school and I saw literally every single girl was, you know, struggling with their bag, where they didn't want to carry a Longchamp because it looked a little too juvenile or a little too casual. They wanted to be taken seriously. People were typically like in their late 20s. They wanted to look sort of mid-level. A flashy bag like a Louis Vuitton or a Gucci was too flashy to be professional. So when they would go to recruiting events, it was just sort of like, oh my God, what am I going to carry? Like, there's nothing appropriate. And also trying to pull out, you know, your resume and then like charging, you know, charging cords and everything flying out at the same time. Exactly. I actually went in with another business idea. But when I saw that there were so many people who were like, yes, I need a brand like this, I was like, yes, I'm definitely pursuing this. And I hit the ground running.
And so where were you coming in with the idea and where are you when you're done with business school?
So I came in with the idea, but I had another one that I was like, I was pursuing more. But then after one semester, I was like, yes, no, I'm definitely pursuing what has now become Dakne Dover. And I was like, okay, I definitely don't want to be a solo founder because there's just so much going on. There's no way you're going to be good at everything. I knew my strengths and I knew areas where there was just far better talent. So I wanted two particular types of co-founders. One, a creative who could be like the face who people could emote, you know, and understand this was coming from this person's heart and mind and artistic ability. And then I wanted someone who was far more technical and analytical than me because I was not certainly a traditional business person. So I wanted someone who would obsess about the details and frankly be really good at math. So there were several women who were really interested in joining my independent study with this famous professor named Professor Bell. He's like known as like the e-commerce academia expert. He is an investor and advisor to many brands. But anyway, so I started this independent study with him and they joined. And then I also invited Jesse, who I had been working with on a freelance basis, to come down from New York to also participate in the independent study. And we would see, you know, how it went at the end of the semester to see where we shook out and what made sense in terms of the founding team. So then we started working on it basically from the beginning of 2012. It took a long time for all this to get done. And then we started to, you know, win some awards. Like we won the Wharton Venture Award, which is a $10,000 grant that had previously been won by also Warby Parker and some other brands. We were the first MBA company funded by Dormroom Fund, which is powered by First Round Capital. So that was, you know, another investment to help us. And it was just a slow grind of just trying to get friends and family investments, basically raise about $200K to test out the concept and build it enough where we could get traction to attract a prolific angel investor who ended up leading our seed round.
So you have this idea, you have a team now. What do you need to get to the point where you're de-risking the concept? Is it we need to launch a single thing? Is it we need 15 different products? How does that process unfold?
Well, for us, we felt that we really needed to see unit velocity. And I say that in a way that's like only relative to where we were at that time, which is like, you know, not just sell like 10 units, but like sell like 100 units behind like two particular products that we felt were going to be like staples to our collection. And they're still on our site today. So one is what is known now as the Legend Tote. It fits up to a 15-inch laptop. And it's the bag that you rely on Monday through Friday. People often can carry it on the weekends as well. But it's just that bag that has everything that you need when you need it for your MetroCard when you're getting on the subway, to your keys, you know, when you're getting home at 2 a.m. after Thursday happy hour or whatever it is, to, of course, your laptop, your notebook, everything in its place, your shake in the morning or whatever, your water. But that bag definitely sold immediately, and we saw that we had product market fit. The second item that we had launched at the same time was a day-to-evening solution, and that was called the Clutch Wallet. Today, it's called the Essentials Clutch Wallet. It's a clutch, but it's also a wallet. So you have card slots, you have a place for your lip gloss so it stays in place, you have a little key hook so that those are there. but it looks like a chic clutch. So you don't have to like rearrange your whole life if you're going out at night. And if you need to put stuff into another clutch to take out, everything is already in your bag. You take that out. You can either keep your bag, your big tote at work, or you can coat check it or whatever, but you have everything you need right there. We felt very strongly that those were going to be two needs of our demographic. And the fact that we were able to sell out of all the capacity that we could make for that year, 2013, within basically the first 6 months of going live in that March, was very successful to us. And we could show enough traction to get the right types of investors involved.
How long did it take to develop those products to the point that you launched them?
Oh my gosh. Well, I mean, I think we went through like 9 samples of the tote. And for the Essentials Clutch Wallet, I mean, we went through many samples, but then we also revamped it about a year and a half ago. So it's an evolving thing. But in terms of just getting to launch, it took a lot of iterations, way more than I think is normal has been normal in the industry. But we weren't going after something that's only going to live one season, right? These are silhouettes. When we invest in a silhouette, it needs to live for years. It needs to be a multi-million dollar silhouette. We believe in the silhouettes and the function and the aesthetic they provide. So it took a long time, but we were able to find really awesome partners from our sample makers to, you know, eventually full scale production, who was willing to spend that time to perfect it with us and the supply chain as well.
And were you doing that domestically or internationally?
It started domestically. We were working with a sample room / small factory here in New York City, but we very quickly maxed out their capacity. So it was time to move abroad, which is great because we were able to close our seed round and get the funds in order to do that.
In that first round of sellouts, who's buying at that point?
It was mostly people from our network or like 2 or 3 degrees beyond that. When we were sort of engineering the product and making sure that we were hitting on all the right attributes, from the length of the key strap to the length of the what you call the drop length, which is how high the handles go and how easily you can get it over your shoulder, we had surveyed and focus grouped about 1,000 women and men, mostly stemming from the Wharton community, but then they sent it on to other friends and family. So we got a really nice group of information. And so when we actually were ready to launch our product, then we let them know, hey, thanks so much for participating in focus groups last year. This is actually what it looks like. If you would purchase it, then here's a link. And people did, and they sent it to their friends and family and so on. So it was really incredible. This was not done on like a Kickstarter or any other type of site. It was our own site. We always kept the branding and the experience to be, you know, owned by us. But it was incredible that people came and that they bought.
And so at this point, often with these sorts of companies, I ask, like, why did this not exist before?
Because
there were clearly no shortage of bags.
Right, totally.
Out there. Did you have an opinion on that at this point?
Yeah.
And then do you have different one now?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's just more reinforced at this point. But at that point, imagine it being 2009 when I came up with the idea. I was at a loss for what to carry. I was always carrying Coach because that's what was free, frankly, or what I had a 50% off discount for. But it wasn't something I'd ever carried prior. And it's because there's something about feeling connected to brands, right? And that's why we have such brand affinity today. When people see a company that is led by 3 female millennials who look different, who came from different backgrounds, sure, we all came from the retail industry, but very different parts of the retail industry. Deep is the analytical one. I'm sales and management. Jesse's design. And we all came together around the need for this company and the need for this brand. And the imagery and the content is so positive. It is so uplifting. It's all about possibility and also a two-way dialogue on our Instagram, on customer service. Like, we take feedback because we're not trying to be like a push marketing company. We've never been that way. We can only be great if we listen to our fan base. That is very different from most of fashion. And for the older generation of traditional brands that we grew up loving and knowing, those people who are making decisions, those people who are the faces of those brands, are not us. You know, they're not female often. And they're also not our generation. They don't live our lifestyle. They don't know our needs from day to evening. They don't know that we're out from 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. and what we're doing, because they have a different life now. You know, so I think that people really love the fact that they were seeing people just like them.
I had Eleanor from Argent on here too, and it was a similar idea of their whole thing is like super functional kind of power suiting for women, that like all of the function was just entirely available for guys.
Mm-hmm.
And it took an immensely long amount of time to even give women pockets.
Absolutely.
In a similar vein, there are endless gym bags I could go get at any given moment, but it seems that the function curve is like very skewed towards men.
But the truth is that like it's not about it being like, oh, a bag with pockets. Like, a lot of people can produce a bag with pockets, even though like not this quality, not this, you know. But it's about the aesthetic too. It's about the thoughtfulness of the pockets. It's about the marketing imagery that goes with it.
Right.
It's about the messaging that we stand for. It's about how it makes you feel. That's ultimately why someone likes your product, is because of how good it makes you feel. And Yes, there are copycats out there. Yes, there are other brands that, you know, do something maybe kind of somewhat similar to us, but not the way that we do it.
Right. And it would seem that often function comes at the expense of the aesthetics and
right.
all those
and
things as well.
It does not have to.
Okay. So you sell these things out. You have the start. Is the next step you go out and raise the first round, or
yeah.
where do you go from there?
So we raised our first round in 2014. It was small. We've always taken very, very small amounts of money.
Why?
Because we want to maintain control of the company. And we also, you know, we come from retail. The three of us knew what we were doing. We were able to run the company for the first 2.5 years by ourselves, three people. You don't really see that. So we just felt we didn't need to spend a lot of money on talent to begin with. And also, we are people who believe in if we take in a dollar, we have to make three with it.
It's very, very rare opinion in this industry
right
now.
It is. But we feel that that's the most responsible way. And even though it's a lot harder, I'm like, gosh, those first 3 years were really, really, really hard. It's so worth it. Now, we totally control our destiny. And we were able to get so far on so little and gain so much respect from investors, from people in the industry. You know, world's our oyster because of those sacrifices.
And so you go out and raise a round.
Yep.
What are you going into that with a goal of?
Yeah.
We're going to go use the money to do X. And then what happens after that?
Sell. So it was all about, you know, we're not putting a bunch of money into marketing per se. It's really about the product. We know that once we get the product in front of people, people are walking showrooms for it. So people say like, oh my gosh, I really love that color. They'd be like, oh my gosh, let me tell you, this is Dagny Dover. Like, you have to go get this bag. And they show them all the features. So we didn't need to pump a lot of money into marketing. In fact, we only started digital marketing in a very small way at the beginning of 2015. So keep in mind, we went to pre-sale 2013. We like went back in stock with a lot more inventory once we had, you know, scaled production abroad towards the end of 2014.
Mm-hmm. Still two SKUs?
Four or five SKUs by holiday of that time. And then 2015 is when we just started to market in a very small way. So it was really relying on just pumping inventory. We just didn't have enough units that we could sell. We were constantly out of stock. Now we're in a much better place. But, you know, at the very beginning, we were just constantly out of stock because we couldn't get working capital loans. Mm-hmm. Our hands were tied in so many ways. So we really just had to, again, continue to push sales and prove that there was even stronger product market fit before we could even think about investing in marketing or anything beyond that.
When did you raise the first real round?
2014.
And you said you ended that year with a few more SKUs.
Yes.
So talk about what was working with the two and then where you decide to go from there.
Those two were really just like the baseline of what we needed to like just start something. But we knew that people wanted other options. So for example, they wanted a crossbody bag and they wanted one that also had handles that folded down so that it could be a little bit more compact. So we launched what is now called the midi tote. And then we also launched a really small bag that's also known as the petite tote today, which was just like a really fun brunch bag, something that you could wear out during the day, out during the evening. It always looked great, super cute, a great price point. And again, still had the functionality, even though it's small, you can still clip your keys everywhere and you know where stuff is. And then additionally to that, we also had just like a small card case where people could, you know, card cases, typically you're giving a business card and you're getting a business card, but typically card cases have like one pocket. It's like, no, you need at least two. So this one had three pockets for that functionality. So that was rounding out the signature collection. And that's basically what it is today.
Talk a bit more about kind of aesthetics in terms of where you wanted to aim. And then I'm also curious to talk about price point.
So with that signature collection, it was really important for us to keep it under $300. It was really important
for everything.
The bigger bags are, I think the most expensive one is $265. And we really wanted to hit that like $250 price point across that whole collection for the bigger bags, because we knew that that's where we would win. And also that it signaled quality, and it is incredibly high quality materials, but it also, you know, was attainable for people who were switching maybe from a Kors, a Coach, a Marc Jacobs, a Tory. Typically, they're buying those brands 25% off at a department store or so on, or at least at the time they were. So it was still more compelling given that discount. And of course, all the functionality, which is very expensive to produce and very expensive to work in there.
Talk more about that.
You know, our bags require 2 times the amount of material and 1.5 times the amount of labor. If you're thinking about like a pricing standpoint, our bags are really expensive to make. But us being smarter about what distribution channels that we always sell through and commit to and those terms makes it possible so that we can provide that to our customer, and as long as most of our business is direct to consumer. So that was always a part of our strategy. We were never planning to be like a strong wholesale business. Having come from wholesale myself, I saw the benefits and I also saw, you know, the areas of caution. It's direct to consumer. This is the era where people are more knowledgeable and smarter, and just they understand materials better than ever before. I think that prior to 5 years ago, everyone thought that a Louis Vuitton bag was made out of leather. And now I think a lot of people know it's coated canvas, which is the same material that we use for our signature collection. But at the same time, it still is durable. It still looks, you know, luxurious. Code of Canvas was really important to us because our girl is someone who is in the rain, who is out trekking, you know, at all hours. She needs to make sure that she's not going to ruin her bag if she gets stuck in a downpour or if she gets, you know, a bottle of wine spilled all over her at happy hour, which happens. You know, life happens. Life is not perfect. And it's okay that it's messy because we're prepared for it. And that's really what we stand for with all the materials that we choose. Our neoprene collection called 365 can be hand washed, which is amazing, but it also keeps its really nice structure, almost like leather, but still is sporty and practical too.
Do you find yourself pulling customers away from luxury that would normally buy it?
So what's interesting is that our customer is typically being pulled away from other affordable luxury. So she's being pulled away from Kate Spade, from Coach, from Tory, from Marc Jacobs, but she is not replacing Hermes, Chanel, Louis. We're sitting next to those brands in her closet because they serve a different purpose to her. You know, these are not the everyday bags that you're using. You're wearing Chanel for a special occasion. You're wearing Hermes when you want to make a statement. So it's a very different purpose. But in terms of being the go-to everyday bag, yes, we are that.
Do you think you'd ever go up market?
Well, we do have a collection, our leather collection, that's priced up to $500. I'd say the sweet spot is really around $350. And that collection does really well. $350 for a leather bag that is beautiful and functional, it's exceptional value.
Okay, so where are you at the end of 2014 then?
At the end of 2014, we have just gone back live because we were offline for 8.5 months of the year while we were moving production abroad, finishing our capital raise, blah, 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 blah.
Was that hard?
Yes, everything was hard. 2014 was really hard. And we were building our team, so we started to hire our first two people. That was very exciting. And then 2015 was, okay, like, off to the races. People are buying. Like, our first day back in stock in August of 2014 was amazing because we were like, okay, we've been offline for 8.5 months. Are people actually going to remember us? Mm-hmm. Even though we have all these thousands of people on a wait list, it's another thing to actually put your money down and say, like, okay, I'm actually doing this. But we had an amazing first day back in stock, blew away any expectations that we had. And the rest of the year was amazing as well. 2015 was really like, okay, we're going to start pumping this. We're going to start dabbling into digital. Digital was incredible. 2016, actually, we were recognized for how successful we were performing on digital. And Instagram actually reached out to us for their 1-year anniversary of advertising. And they were like, hey, you guys are actually our number one performing advertiser on all of Instagram out of 1.5 million brands. Your ROI is higher than anyone else. We're like, what is going on? And they were pinpointing the exact images that we'd used and the exact copy and who we had segmented and everything. And it was really like that top-down image of the bag with the side image where you can see inside all the pockets. And of course, it being like a bag that's like pink or, you know, something that's a fashionable color and a lifestyle type of shot where people just feel emotionally like, oh my gosh, I need to have that bag right now. It's going to solve all my problems and everyone I know needs to have that bag too. That's really what captures people, and that really what hits them over the head and says, what makes us so different? It's not just arm candy. This is something that helps you perform better on a daily basis. So it was really cool that we got such early validation from them. We also got some early validation from some other partners as well, where we were like case studies for them, like for Spring, the shopping app a few years ago. It was really cool to get validation sort of on all parts, from logistics and how we run our business to, you know, design and people being interested in that way, to a slew of retailers started reaching out to us about 18 months ago as well.
Was that downtime, would you have done it differently if you could do it again, or it was unavoidable?
It was so necessary. That's just the amount of time it takes to get up and running with a factory. And we didn't have money to pay the factory unless we raised capital. First time raise is the hardest thing I've ever done.
We're kind of, I guess, now into 2016-ish as you start to turn on digital. So up until this point, you're selling entirely direct to consumer.
We are. 2016 was all direct to consumer.
So we know a little bit now about the results of that from Instagram and so forth. But how do you approach where you start to spend money, and what do you look for from the different channel options you have?
Yeah, we were really just still focused on digital. We're only recently have gone, you know, offline and looked at other channels or started dabbling in other channels. But it really was just between Facebook, Instagram, and Google. And it was highly effective. And we did not see a plateau. So we were just continuing to work with it. That being said, we also were not a company, since how we use our funds, we weren't a company that was just pumping our marketing at all. We were doing it in a very cadenced way so that we could adjust quickly before wasting any money. We were much more willing to put more money in inventory and production and just being able to test with more different types of styles than to waste any money unnecessarily in advertising when we knew 50% of our traffic was coming from people directly going to DaggyDover.com. We just didn't need to spend money in that way.
So any other kind of, I guess, highlights throughout 2016?
2016. it sounds really terrible that I can't think of any, but I know that, I mean, we had some amazing, 2015, we were in Oprah Magazine. That happened organically on Gail's, like, editor-in-chief page. We started to get a lot of press around business, around lifestyle, around fashion. We were in Forbes a bajillion times. That's really when I think it started to look a little bit larger than life, 2016. And then 2017, in particular, with the retailers, I think it's when, especially when we went live on Nordstrom.com at the end of last year, that's when we really, I think, started to have a bit more of a halo effect around our brand.
And so how did you approach diversifying back into wholesale, which is obviously what you knew well?
So, you know, we were never looking to get with any particular partner at that point in time. Opportunities presented themselves, and basically we had a lot of inbound inquiries. And from there, we decided, okay, which are the ones that make sense for our business? Equinox is fantastic from a brand alignment perspective, as well as number of door perspective and covering across the country. Right now, we're in 15 doors. By this fall, we'll be in 50. That's awesome. We know that our customer is going there and she's looking at them for recommendations for what to buy. So that we knew was fantastic. Bandier, we grew up with them. They are an awesome brand. They have a great eye, and we've always been very supportive of each other's businesses. So we were really happy to go live with them. And in particular, this year, our business with them has just been, I mean, phenomenally strong. And then we went live with Nordstrom.com this past fall, winter, and immediately, I mean, immediately shot up to being a top performing brand on Nordstrom.com, which is incredible.
What is the, I guess, growing success of the wholesale tell you about both that channel, and also how do you look at just the mix going forward?
I mean, we like to keep it tight. We chose each of those members for a very distinct reason. Nordstrom, they're fantastic for customer experience as well as for curation. My team and I, we all shop on Nordstrom. It's something that you trust, that you know is reliable. And we looked at them as sort of like the reliable, fashionable mass retailer that we're going with. We're not interested in going with a bunch of department stores. We're not interested in going with a bunch of retailers that fit in that category. That's the one. In the same way that Equinox is the one for lifestyle gym, in the way that Bandier is the one for millennial, you know, more New York centric type of activewear person. And then, you know, in terms of the other retailers that we are working with and going forward in the future, they're going to be ones that fall outside of those categories, but still the same sort of mindset. The way that we think about our customer base is really not based on demographic. At this point, our customers are everywhere in the world. But it really is about psychographic. Is this someone who maybe reads a skim every day? Someone who's reading Forbes? Someone who cares about their career? Is this someone who is using Amazon Prime or some other site or retailer where, you know, they know what the shipping is going to be? They know what the turnaround is going to be? Someone who is comfortable online shopping actively? Someone who goes to SoulCycle or goes someplace where, you know, it's more than just a workout, it's an experience? Is this someone who is basically forward-thinking and trying to optimize their life? Someone who uses services and products that multitask, that are data driven, and that are better than the status quo? Because that's what we do for everything. It's really retailers that have audiences like that.
So I remember when Kitten Ace kind of came out, if you went and looked at their like about page, there was like a section on our customer, and it literally read something like, our customer is a person that gets up at 6 a.m, goes for a run, like goes to work for an hour, goes kayaking, plays basketball at lunch, goes to happy hour, gets on a dinner party, and like takes a red eye home. And they had built this like segmentation that effectively was nobody.
Right.
I don't know why, but they had seemed to do that. And it was interesting from the perspective of, if you know who founded it and so forth, that it somewhat assumes like private jet travel is like part of the life and you can kind of go and do anything you want at any time and there are kind of no rules. That often happens, I think, with companies where people create something for themselves. How did you, or continually do you, avoid doing something where it's like, yes, it solves my problem, but I don't know if that solves everyone's problem?
Yeah.
And balance what could be very valid intuition versus like actual wider resonance.
That can be one of the differences between what makes a partnership between multiple founders really strong and valuable versus when it's a solo founder or maybe even just two people who are similar. Me, Deepa, and Jesse are very much litmus checks for each other, where if someone's feeling like, oh, like everyone's going to love this, and we're like, what are you talking about? Like that is like 5% of the, you know, of people out there. That's helpful. Not only that, but we really, really rely heavily on data. From the get-go, we have been tracking our data because that is gold. You know, so getting feedback from customers actively and consistently is really important. And that plays into design decisions. And it becomes very clear when a million people are saying, hey, we want a gym bag. Like, we know exactly that this is going to have product market fit. We just need to make sure that we build it in the way that they told us to build it, add our own things to it that make it special and that make it Dagny. But we know that people have been wanting it and asking for it.
Right. But at the same time, also knowing or taking the opportunity to put things out that they haven't yet asked for.
Totally.
Because no one necessarily asked for the brand.
I think just from that initial inception, it's because I just seen it so much. Of course, I looked at lots of spreadsheets. Of course, I looked at lots of information when I was at corporate and I saw that people want something like this. It's also talking to people. It's also living your life. It's also talking to friends. Like, this is not just one type of person. It's not just one age of a person. It's not just one, whatever, educational group of a person. It doesn't matter if you are a 15-year-old still in high school, you want Dagny. And we've had many customers, actually, who are starting young, starting in high school, because they want to feel on top of their A game. Who doesn't want to feel confident and prepared every day? That spans across every generation.
Bring us up to, I guess, 2018 in terms of, like, I guess, like highs or lows of 2017.
2017 was an awesome year. You know, we are a very, very, very small team. I'm so proud of what we're able to accomplish together. We right now are 13 people executing this business and feeling so confident and good and proud of it all. And I think what I'm most proud is how well everyone works together, because everything can look glossy and perfect on the outside to anyone. Anyone can fake that. But when it's a joy to go to work every day and people are, I mean, they're friends that you just happen to work with, that's what makes life actually meaningful. You know, it's not work anymore. It becomes so much more than that. So that's what I'm most proud about, that we're really in an amazing cadence in terms of a team. And then 2018, I mean, this is the year we just explode. Like, there's so much going on. None of it can be revealed now. But oh my gosh, this is our year. You know, coming off of last week with Dagny Summer Games, it was everything we had always wanted it to be.
So talk more about that.
Sure. So it's our 5-year birthday. And the idea behind it was that, you know, on Instagram, you see all these amazing events that happen. For example, the Revolve House or whatever. And it's only for bloggers. It's only for people who live a certain lifestyle, who are, you know, have certain status. And it's just so not our brand. Our brand is so inclusive and you can sit with us, that we wanted to have an event where people felt really comfortable to come hang out, come as you are, enjoy games, have fun, get a manicure, maybe look at the bags, you know, but come and hang out. And so we wanted to have like a Soho block party. So we called it Dagny Summer Games. And we had cornhole, we had ping pong, we had a beach that we made people could just hang out in. We had a reading nook for people who just didn't want to socialize, but, you know, wanted to check it out, who wanted to check some of our favorite reads out as well. People who wanted to get portraits done or headshots done, they could, with a fashion photographer. They could write on our Love is a Superpower wall, where they filled in what their superpower is. Love is a Superpower was the name of our spring summer campaign. So it's all about equality and unity and friendship and togetherness and just positive vibes, you know. And then for any activity that people did, whether it was checkers, Connect Four, like whatever, then you got a ticket. And when you got tickets, if you got 5 tickets, you could redeem for a manicure. If you got 3 tickets, you can redeem to get your hair done. You can get a headshot done for 1 ticket. You can get career tarot card reading for 2 tickets, you know. But this idea of like, it's just fun. And we had a lot of people who came and hung out, honestly, for like 2 or 3 days. Once they came the first day, they were like, I will just bring all my friends here and this will be my weekend. And you could also redeem for beverages at the bar. So they were having, you know, La Colombe coffee or La Croix or whatever it was. And it was just fun and chill. And there weren't any expectations. You didn't have to buy anything. Everything was appropriate. Everyone just had some good, clean, like happy fun. And that's what we wanted. We just wanted people to get to know our brand for the first time, but no pressure of anything.
It sounds like you've done other events before, but was this the first like real offline thing?
This is the first major one we did. We did a pop-up 2 years ago in Soho as well. It was a very small footprint and it really was just a store. There was not space to create a whole experience around this. This, you saw every facet of who we are, I think.
Do you think you're going to do more of those?
That was a pretty big activation for us, a big 5-year birthday. I think that the next one we'll look at is definitely the 10-year, but, you know, there might be something in between. This was hugely successful, so we're going to have to hindsight and see, you know, what we want to do in the future.
What has been the cheapest and most expensive lesson you've learned building the company so far?
So when we went back in stock, so this was in fall of 2014, we rushed a product launch of the Midi Tote. And basically, it missed a step in the quality control process, and bags are falling apart. Disaster. Disaster. This is the third product that we're launching. People have been waiting all this time for us to be back in stock with the other 2 products. We launched this product, and like, something's not going right. Like, you know, we don't have tens of thousands of dollars to burn. And so, first of all, it was a PR nightmare, too, right? Because so many editors and everyone had been gifted this bag. Terrible. And we were able to message everyone who had gotten a bag, apologize profusely, let them know that please destroy the bag or give it back to us and we will send you a new one and it will not happen again. And people were really nice about it. It ended up being a very small cost to us in the end in terms of how many bags we needed to destroy and how big the problem was. But it was a costly error to make at that point in the business where we were still trying to show that we were a real brand and that we were a quality brand. So it was tough and it hurt, but it was so good that we learned it then instead of having to learn it later on. We were at the beginning of our production experience life. Luckily, we were able to hire someone shortly thereafter who is now our VP of sourcing and production. This will never happen, you know, has never happened after that and will never happen because she is a veteran of the industry. But that's what happens when you don't have 20 years under your belt and you're doing something, even if you're working with the most amazing factories, if you're rushing something because you want to hit a certain timeline of getting to launch to prove yourself, like almost never is that a good idea. So that was very helpful to learn.
And what about cheapest?
Basically, when the world was falling apart, or rather the handbag world was falling apart, and a lot of these other brands, these big brands, these big affordable luxury brands were cutting their orders 50% because people weren't buying their bags, the factory that we were working with at the time was Hemerdrink. And they had a huge issue on their hands because, of course, they had facilities and workers that they need to pay and need to figure out a way to survive. And since we were the smallest brand, I mean, by far on their list, we were the first ones to go. They said, we can't even deal with you right now. We're just trying to survive. We need to figure out how to replace, like, you know, millions of orders ASAP. You need to give us $300,000 before we ship your last shipment. First of all, it's like, okay, we need a new factory, which is like crazy because that does not happen over, you know, just a few months. And second of all, we don't have $300,000 to, you know, pay for our last shipment to be able to pay them. But one of the most valuable lessons is really maintaining relationships. Our investors, we've always been very, very, very careful as to who we brought on board, really good people who were understanding of us and who knew us personally, that we were going to do whatever it took when times got rough. And we called up one of our investors who, you know, he did not put in a lot of money to our business. It's not like he had $300,000 lying around, but we told him the situation and we asked him for a loan. And he gave us a loan. And within 2 weeks, the situation was resolved and we were able to pay off the loan 2 years later. So that was extreme trust. This guy was not friends and family. This guy is who we refer to as our number one rando. He was the number one random person who invested in our business just based off of trusting us. It was very, very, very early on. And the fact that he felt that confidence in us was so invaluable. You really just can't replace good people.
Right. And relationships and so forth.
And maintaining them. It's not like we called him up out of the blue. Like, this is someone who we were constantly in contact with because he just was a good person.
So you're at 5 years now. Mm-hmm. What have you learned about time? For everything, you know, we've ever learned, it basically takes 10 years to establish a brand. No amount of money generally will shortcut that process. And so given you're almost at like that halfway point, in terms of expectations you had about where you would be 5 years ago to now, or what have some of the lessons or insights been around just time?
You know, when we launched the brand, it was 2013, which was a very different point in time for people who are building brands. Today, it's a very different landscape. At the time, with Jessie being, you know, a founding member, we could get by because she had a design aesthetic. She made the logo. She did the coloring. She did the aesthetics. Like, we never looked like we didn't know what we were doing. It's more refined today, but we could get away with it. Today in 2018, you can't really get away with it in the same way that maybe we did. But now people do spend, you know, a couple $100,000 on the branding up front. That's the norm. And that is just never a decision that we made. You know, we were always a product first company and we were able to do that and raise very little money doing that and maintain control and all of that, because of where we were in the life cycle of direct-to-consumer brands. Today, I think you have to raise more money, give away more control, and that's a little unfortunate, but also you have the opportunity to grow faster because of it. It's easier than ever, right, to get in front of customers. So in terms of time, the first 3 years in particular were brutal in that it's all about survival. It's, are we going to make it? You know, it's begging someone for a $25,000 check, you know, like it's really, really, really tough. You're still establishing the fact that you deserve to be in business and that you will be in business, getting people to trust you. At this point, yes, it's still stressful, but it is so much of a joy because it's all upside. We've gotten past the point of, are we going to survive? Are we going to thrive? It's about, okay, how do we want to do this? What is the way that feels the most organic and authentic to us? We never had to compromise in any real ways or take on investment from people that we didn't want to survive or whatever it is. We did it our way and we've got this. We've weathered so many things that we know that whatever comes up in the future, we've totally got this. So this is a really fun period for us where, of course, it's all new. Of course, it's new, different challenges with people, with, you know, doing bigger things and putting a lot more money behind these things, and they have to pay off for us in some way. But there's a lot more certainty because we have a lot more data to support it, too. So it's really just an exciting time for our brand.
And so on that note, how big do you think this can get? And then how big do you actually want it to get?
We think that this brand can be one of the biggest in the accessory space and beyond. Even though we are an accessories brand, we don't even like calling ourselves just that because it's so much more than that. It really is a mindset. And we're definitely going to move beyond bags at some point. It's just that this is where we're playing in right now. This is what we're owning right now. And we're all about slow and steady. We're all about mastering something before spreading ourselves too thin. In terms of how big this can get, I don't really want to throw out numbers, but we see ourselves as the next generation of traditional bag brands and beyond that, beyond traditional lifestyle brands as well. And in terms of how big we want it to get, for us, it's not so much about a size, it's about a feel. You know, there are companies out there that can still feel really intimate and really fulfilling, you know, even though there are a couple hundred employees or whatever. We're at 13 right now. I don't know what it's going to feel like at 50. We have an idea of what it's going to feel like at 50, but that itself is going to be challenging. So we're just so not built like any other company, honestly. It's really hard to look at other companies and say, oh, I think we can be like them or whatever. We're going to be our own entity. I think we have the potential to have a huge business, but again, the team might end up being quite small that actually ends up executing it.
What do you think is misunderstood about the brand that you want to correct?
You know, I think at the beginning, we were known to be like a working woman's bag brand. And that was because of the first product that we had was the tote, the Legend tote, which is, it very much looks like a Monday through Friday type of bag. That being said, we very quickly in 2016 and 2017, you know, came out with new collections that rounded out our lifestyle. So it's much more diversified at this point. It's certainly not just for women. Our 365 collection, a lot of men buy it, and it is made to be a unisex collection. So I think something that is misunderstood is when people think of us as a women's like working bag brand, when really we're all about a mindset.
What are you most excited about that's on the horizon in the next, I guess, year or two that you're looking forward to?
There are some amazing things in the works, not only with the retail partners and the type of exposure and visibility that we're going to get, but also just helping redefine us as a brand and about who this product and this brand is made for in a very, very strong way. So that is super exciting. And then also just in terms of brand partners or other types of alignments, so many people are reaching out to us right now, organizations, conferences, etc., that are amazing and incredible. And us being associated with them in any way is going to be game changing. So to be part of that in the next, you know, 12 months is something that we're really looking forward to as well.
Very cool. And where's the name from?
Dagny is a Nordic word for new day, and Dover is Jesse's last name. So what we say is like, you know, we're really a new day for design, for bags, for living your life, where you really just don't need to compromise on aesthetics or how something works for you. We're really rooted in performance. So it's all about today's day. Go get it.
Awesome. Thanks so much for talking.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Loose Threads podcast. You can read full transcripts of the podcast and join the newsletter at loosethreads.com. Feel free to also leave a review on iTunes. We always appreciate it. And thanks to George Drake Jr. for editing this episode. We have a great roster of upcoming guests, including Mickey Berardelli of Kidbox, Barry Beck of Blue Mercury, and Bushra Izrahui of Our8. Thanks for listening, and talk to you soon.